Welcome to Movie Richard's Movie Month, where the Atlantic Voice Network's very own in-house critic, Movie Richard, looks at what's out and about to be out at your local multiplex. I'm Zeph, and here now, the man at the concession stand, Movie Richard. Welcome to Movie Richard's Movie Month. Richard is right here. Movie Richard, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Happy to be back.
Happy to be back. It's our show for August. We're doing Quentin Tarantino, but first, a clip.
Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind.
Lawrence Fishburne, a big scene, a famous scene from the original Matrix movie with Keanu Reeves as Neo. We played that not because we both think Keanu Reeves and Lawrence Fishburne are terrific in nearly everything they do, but because the news has hit the internet that there will be another Matrix movie. Movie Richard, do we need another Matrix movie?
I know everybody is in love with the John Wick franchise. I absolutely loved Keanu Reeves kind of popping up in one of the most popular films on Netflix, a rom-com, Asian rom-com.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah,
I saw that. He was brilliant in it.
He was great.
What's it called? I can't remember.
Oh, my goodness. It is so good.
My wife turned it on, yeah. And I'm sitting there thinking, is this what we're watching on Netflix? Because I saw rom-com. And I'm like, what the hey? Anyway, like, I will look up what it's called while you keep...
Be My Maybe. I have to say, no, we don't need another Matrix. I've heavily debated. I mean, there have been two breakout stories this year, this weekend. Matrix is coming back. The MCU Spider-Man issue. Talking about the Matrix. I just don't want to see another one.
Did you watch all three? I mean, were you quite religious when they... I mean, I saw the first one.
Yes.
And like most times, I'm like, okay, I've seen what I needed to see. So when two and three came out, I wasn't overly...
All in on all of them. Like, probably seen them all 5-10 times a piece. Like, in that time frame, I was just going and seeing them. I was all about the Matrix.
I'll shout out another movie franchise in a moment in terms of this same thing. Did they make it? Like, when you saw the last of those three... Did you feel that the story was told?
Yes.
So that trilogy worked for what it was.
I mean, if honestly, I thought that they could have ended it halfway through the final movie. I mean, I thought the story was completely told. Okay, we have this guy Neo. Is he the one or not? We have the machines kind of taken over. Can he stand up to them? All right, we have the answer now. So to me, unless they were going to come out with films that were like spinoffs, like we get to learn about the agents or we get to learn about some of the other characters, I was perfectly fine with how it ended. Actually, a little frustrated. A part of me was like they kind of went an hour longer than they needed to. But for some reason, with how hot Keanu Reeves has been within like – it just feels like the last year or so, maybe 2 years.
Yeah, it's a bit of a resurgence, isn't it?
It kind of felt
Bill
like
and Ted
this was
is coming,
coming
back, which in a strange way, I'm less offended by.
Absolutely.
I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah, I know I'll go see it. I mean, in this time period with this way the special effects are
probably
going to
be. Well, you can't be movie Richard and not
I
go
have to
see
go
it,
see it, but I could have easily gone without it.
I felt the same way because I watched it in bits. Mm-hmm. I've still not watched it start to finish in its entirety in order. I've watched bits of it. I felt the same way about Jason Bourne, the fourth one with Tommy Lee Jones. I felt like, you know, Identity, Supremacy, and then Ultimatum. Mm. And at the end of Ultimatum, spoiler, he finds out who he is and how he got to be Jason Bourne. Mm-hmm. I felt like the story was there. It'd come to a... And they have that great scene at the end of the third one where he's lying in the water because mm-hmm. he's fallen off, which is how the first one
started. Yeah.
And at that moment, I'm like, you, from a storytelling perspective, you have told the perfect story. literally, creatively, artistically.
Absolutely.
And then Jason Bourne comes along and it's basically, yep, let's just do another fist fight, another car crash, another this. Yeah. And I'm like,
felt like Mission Impossible.
Yeah, like, what are we doing here? And I'm why.
Great film, though. I like
it. Yes. And I'm why the Matrix 4, which is what we're going to call it right now.
Yeah. I don't know where they're going with it. I have no idea. Like, now that we have all the answers, unless they're just going to go into a whole different world of simulation with the cast that they are bringing back, with all the sequels and things that are being brought up, with all the films that are coming out, mostly comic book stuff right now, when I heard of Matrix, I'm like, okay, like, what are you going to do? We've seen all the moves. We've seen the battles. Lord, we've played every video game. We've looked at it from every angle. We have quoted Morpheus for like 10 years. The red and the blue pill thing has become iconic. How do you, like, to me, it's like you could really ruin it with like you just said, kind of with Jason Bourne, even though that was done well. Hey, we're just going to have some action. We're just going to kind of redo what we've done, try to bank in on Keanu Reeves acting, which still is, to me, questionable over the course of his career.
Yeah, he does. That's the thing, is he's not.
Like, is he a top 10 actor right now?
No, he's not. Like, but you know what he is? He's Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
And he does have. I have this discussion I'm going to share with you. I've shared this on my other show. So I'm in a James Bond movie chat room. Yes. It's the only internet chat room I've ever been in. Yeah. I've been a member now for 12 years. Yeah. I'm going to give all my friends at CommanderBond.net a shout out.
Yeah.
I'm currently in a discussion with some other people about why Timothy Dalton never took as James Bond.
Yeah.
And he's a great looking guy. Yeah. He's got 1930s movie star looks.
Yeah.
He's a terrific actor, Shakespearean trained. But ultimately, being a movie star isn't about any of those things. It's just about this unspoken connection that the audience takes. Mm-hmm. And you're right. Keanu Reeves is not a great actor, but he has a persona that people accept and go, that's Keanu Reeves.
It just works.
Yeah.
It just works. But
well, I'll give you the answer for why this is all going on, because this is now going to be the segue into our main topic.
Absolutely.
Hollywood doesn't trust anything that's not a franchise.
Yeah.
And it's trusting franchises. So, so our show, and this is now my clever segue, Richard, our show, we are now going to talk about Quentin Tarantino in his film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I will play a clip shortly. I'm actually mucking around on the internet right now, and stuff is going on that we don't know about, and you can probably hear the voice, so please ignore that.
Yeah.
Quentin Tarantino is a franchise of his own.
Absolutely.
This is his ninth film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. We'll do the clip a little bit later.
Okay.
So much to talk about with this movie. I will say before I start talking to Richard, we're going to do our best to avoid spoilers.
Absolutely.
But there will be spoilers. And if they slip out now, don't say I didn't warn you. But we are going to attempt to do any spoilers towards the end of the movie. First and foremost, in terms of a 2 hour and 45 minute experience in the cinema. And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood charts, fictional actor Rick Dalton, played by Leo DiCaprio.
Absolutely.
His stunt double, Cliff, played by Brad Pitt. And it just seems to be about dudes living in Hollywood.
Absolutely.
So much is said about the fact that it's going to focus on the Manson murders and Margot Robbie plays Sharon Tate.
Yeah.
But I felt it ended up just being
Hollywood in that
about
time
life
period.
In Hollywood.
Yeah.
Richard, did you like
Loved
So
it.
Trite? Did you like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood
Loved
and
it.
Why?
And this is one of the few films that for me, and as I get further and further away from it, I've seen it twice.
Interesting. I've seen it once and I'm now ready to see it again.
Yeah, but and I did it after that conversation we had actually about like you get away from it. And I started going like I liked it when I left the film. I was like, this is for me 5 stars. I very rarely say 5 stars about anything. I put it right there in my like top 15 list of like perfect films. Inception, one of the Avengers, and this one. I really enjoyed it all the way through without spoiling the very end. I thought the last 40 minutes of the film, just how it was handled and the intensity of it, was a great transition and a great pickup of pace. I loved how they kind of sprinkled in cast members from shows that I watched. Lena Dunham, who's a, you know, that's the whole podcast.
It's got a great cast, isn't it?
A lot
of Kurt Russell, Lena Dunham,
absolutely are in the
Dakota Fanning
is in. Bruce hadn't seen her in forever.
Al Pacino,
absolutely. And I thought it was
what's his name from Justified, who I love.
I know exactly who you're talking about, but with Brad Pitt being, I thought great, if not perfect, with Leonardo DiCaprio. out of 10, I'd say 9, 9.5. I can't say 10 for him because to me a 10 is still The Revenant with the Bear, Wolf of Wall Street, The Great Gatsby. Those are 10, so I'd give him a 9.5, but I loved it.
I guess we should do it because I'm going to play the clip in a minute. I guess let's talk. In fact, let's play the clip now and then we will talk. And then we will talk about the two stars.
Hey, Randy.
Well, so you're still the wreck, huh?
Still here.
You in there?
Yeah, just knock.
Just put them in the wardrobe, all right? What's it going to hurt? Then if you need them, you got them, all right?
Then they got to have a conversation with that wardrobe assistant. And, man, she's a bitch. I just don't. Right, please.
Look, Randy, I'm asking you to help me out, man. If the answer is no, the answer is no. Not no with excuses.
Hey, man. This ain't a Andy McLaughlin picture, you know? And I can't afford to hire a bunch of guys that smoke cigarettes and sit around talking to each other all day on the chance that I might use them. I got a four-man team here, Rick. If I need more than that, I got to get it approved. And, you know, I got to look after my dudes.
Hey, and if your dudes were a better match for me, I'd say, oh, okay, you got me. But that's not the case, and you know it. He's a great match for
me. Yeah,
no. Hey, you could do anything you want to him. Throw him off a building, right? Light him on fire. Hit him with a Lincoln, right? Get creative. Do whatever you want. He's just happy for the opportunity.
Rick?
Yeah.
I don't dig him. And I don't dig the vibe he brings on a set.
Kurt Russell and Leo DiCaprio talking about Brad Pitt's character, Cliff, from the film.
And we forgot Al Pacino was in
it. Al Pacino, yeah.
I forgot about that. And I just wanted to also mention, because I looked up the cast, the young lady who played Trudy, Julia Butters, I thought was incredible. I don't know where they found her from. I'd never seen her in a film before.
And of course, the last celluloid appearance of Luke Perry.
Mm-hmm.
In that. Mm-hmm. So DiCaprio and Pitt, let's talk about the two stars. They've both worked with Tarantino before, as has Russell on a couple of occasions. But let's talk about the two stars.
Well, I mean, I've always enjoyed Brad Pitt. I wouldn't say that I'm as big a fan of him as maybe a Denzel or Leonardo DiCaprio. But okay. If he's in something, I would go see it. I can't ring off as many of his films off the top of my head. But he is somebody who, if he's in a film and he's a headliner, I'll go see it. I thought he was just perfect. Like, for the role, because I was kind of going into the film thinking Leo's going to be the big star, Brad Pitt's going to be a star who doesn't say much. I didn't really think that they were going to be telling his story and that he was going to have as many lines as he did. And even though his story was ultimately kind of subtle and it was had its action, its moments, I just thought it was very well done.
You know, you make an interesting point because I had, and again, I want to be very fair. Richard and I talk about what we're going to do before the show, but we actually haven't had this discussion before. So I don't want anyone to feel like this is all rigged. I felt DiCaprio had a really meaty acting role to get stuck into.
Mm-hmm.
And because he's a great actor, yeah, I believed who he was.
Mm-hmm.
It was Brad Pitt's character was written in such a way that you kind of felt like Brad Pitt was just playing what you imagined Brad Pitt to be. Because he wasn't. He was acting this character.
Yeah.
And so it's two different ways that the actors got to these sort of class A performances.
Yeah.
You know, DiCaprio completely inherits. He's got the voice going. Yeah. DiCaprio's playing this sort of 1960s movie star, sort of the guy who's kind of been slightly like bottom of the Premier League, Hollywood, but clearly trying to resurrect his career, transition into like being a TV name.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting. They were both, in very different ways, both felt like Tarantino had got A performances out of them.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the contrast in both of their individual stories. Like you said, also the characters themselves, where you have this like big Western movie star, action movie star. That's Leonardo DiCaprio, who I guess made a mistake in one casting situation, which hurt him. And then he has to battle with, well, can I be a TV star? Should I do the Italian Westerns? And then you have Brad Pitt as Zeph said, I thought a very accurate depiction. Kind of being Brad Pitt in this
film. That's the thing. And that's the thing. None of us know Brad Pitt.
So
we don't know. But that's interesting. Tarantino had written it in such a way that Brad Pitt was playing what Tarantino guesses most of us think Brad Pitt is like. But clearly he's not.
We don't
like
know
that
guy. But I think about the last film that I loved of his was Troy, like where he was the head, and I watch it every single time. I like Troy more than Gladiator. That's for another show. But I just love how – because his character, Brad Pitt's character, didn't need as much range for what was going on in his story. But somehow just being kind of stoic.
He has – yeah, DiCaprio gets the more –
challenging.
No, yeah. I was going to say, he gets the more sort of showier dialogue-y moments. He's acting with Pacino. Yeah. He's, you know, the section of the movie is actually watching DiCaprio at his regular day job and his struggles. Yeah. And so he's an actor, playing an actor type thing.
I love that. Yeah.
Whereas Pitt, the character's written that you just sort of, he has to tell his character's story not through words, but through this general sort of vibe that he gives off, which does fit.
It worked.
Brad Pitt.
Yeah, and it worked. And so the funnest part about the whole movie and why I had to go see it again, even though ultimately it didn't change if we know who the character is or not, apparently Brad Pitt is playing a guy called Gene LaBelle. And Gene LaBelle is like this legendary mixed martial artist from that time period who is a stuntman. And before we go into some of the scenes in this film where this becomes a big deal, that is a crucial part of the...
Well, he's also playing, apparently, a cross between that character and a guy called Hal Needham, who was Burt Reynolds' stunt double. So it is. It's this sort of weird thing. Yeah, so he is ultimately a compendium, I think, of real people.
Yeah, yeah.
And Tarantino, being the scholar of cinema that he is...
Yeah.
He's not just making it up. You know, he's done his research and he's gone, this dude, there are parts of real people in these dudes. I thought, to your point with the two of them, and this was, because I'm going to make a statement, because we are going to come to, Tarantino has said that he's doing 10 movies and then he's being done, and this is his ninth. So we're at the point now
Star Trek would be the last one.
He says, but he's also said all kinds of stuff. Yeah, yeah. So we are going to get to the point where we decide where this fits in the Quentin Tarantino canon.
Yeah.
It was a surprisingly warm movie.
Absolutely.
And a lot of that is there was something, it's a movie about late 60s, late 70s Hollywood, and yet those two central characters, and now we're talking about the film, within the film, putting Pitt and DiCaprio together is like putting Newman and Redford in the same movie. And the way he wrote their partnership and friendship was very Butch and Sundance-ish in that you believe that these two dudes are friends.
Yeah.
It's different from putting two great actors in as protagonists.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's put them in as buddies.
Yeah.
And that was a very 1960s, 1970s throwback sort of moment too, in terms of, the film is like one of those movies from that time about two dudes in the movie hanging making business.
In the business.
And there was that, the two of them, you really believed that, I know this sounds really almost trite. Yeah, I want to hang out with those guys.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, seriously.
And I don't know if they like each other in real life, but they acted.
It felt like it, like bros.
As bros that had a sort of relationship, a business relationship and whatever. So, but, you know, while we plow through, we're going to come to some of the little controversies. Let's go to the big thing now then, though. Obviously, we both like the film.
Absolutely.
Where does it rank 9 films in with Tarantino's filmography? And I'll throw out some other names. His first movie is Reservoir Dogs, which I always say is the one that is my default because that was the first time I was introduced to him.
Yeah.
He followed that with Pulp Fiction, then Jackie Brown, then Kill Bill, which I've never seen either one of those. I've never seen those.
Good. Very good.
He did the Grindhouse movies with, what's his name, Rodriguez.
Mm-hmm. Sin City? No, that's not.
No, him. I think he was partial. I think he was partial writing whatever.
Hateful Eight.
Hateful Eight.
Django Unchained. Inglourious Blasters.
Bastards. And then this one. Mm-hmm. Where does it fit for you in terms of his filmography?
Well,
because I do think, before I let you talk, I'm sorry, it is different from all the others.
It is. First off, the only ones that I've not seen that he's produced, I have not seen Reservoir Dogs. Cause to me, if you see it like 5 years old, it doesn't count. That came out in 1992. I saw it at probably 95. I was legitimately 4 years
old. Watch it again.
I will watch that one again. Right now. And I have not seen Jackie Brown, but I've seen, I think, everything else. So for me, my favorite, the top films for me have been Django Unchained, number one, Inglourious Basterds, number two, Pulp Fiction, number three, Hateful Eight would have been my number four. And then I had Kill Bill 1 and 2 as my number 5. Now, like I said, I've not
seen... That's prior to Once Upon a Time.
Prior. Okay. Prior. Now, I would put Once Upon a Time as my 1A or 2. So it's either tied with Django Unchained as number 1 or right behind it.
Django Unchained is a great film. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to beat. It gets great performances, doesn't it? Out of every single actor rolls on screen and you feel like... He spent hours making sure that it was the best lines I could write for Leo or Christopher Waltz or Jamie Foxx or
incredible
or Samuel L. Jackson.
Everybody.
I mean, I just said I think it's his warmest movie. Yeah. I think it's his most accessible movie.
Yeah.
I think it's his most personal movie.
I could agree with that.
In terms of, you know, and it was interesting. I read some stuff this week preparing for this show where there was a lot of discussion because the movie's just been released back in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they've done reviews and they talked about it because obviously it was at Cannes, but it was actually, it's just hit general release a couple of weeks after America. And one of the reviews was quite scathing about, you know, sort of, you know, Quentin Tarantino and the violence and the treatment of women. And I'm not sitting here and saying those things do not and have not occurred in his films.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sitting here thinking, no, you've already written an article before seeing the movie. Because this isn't. This isn't a violent movie.
Yeah, you have to
this
see it.
This isn't a movie with until the end.
Last
but
four.
For two and a, but this is not a movie. No, this is not a movie about violence.
Absolutely.
Which Pulp Fiction is, which Reservoir
Kill
Dogs
Bill
is,
one and
which
two
Kill
are.
Bill is.
Hateful Eight.
Hateful Eight is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in a strange way, Inglourious Basterds is a war film.
Yeah.
But most of the violence takes place within the context of that.
Absolutely.
Like, this is almost, it's almost a soap opera is the wrong word, but this is not a violent movie.
Drama, like, it's like
and this is a much warmer movie. It's a very nostalgic film. I mean, I sat there and I think, you know, you talked about how old you were when you saw Reservoir Dogs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 3 or 4 years younger than Quentin Tarantino, and we'll just leave it right there. You can figure out it for yourself. But a lot of the references that he's, you know, there are clips of Mannix on the screen and The Great Escape. And I remember the original FBI story in black and white. Yeah, I'm sitting there going, it's like a trip into his own life.
And what I really enjoyed about it is the flip side of that, not have being born in the 90s, having no real connection to the 60s, 70s, 80s at any level, and being able to kind of see someone that you idolize as a director take a time period that you're only familiar with through YouTube, social media, and songs that are sampled, and really let you in. Now, my father is...
That is a great point.
It was cool
and
to
And the phrase you used, that let you in, I love that you just said
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because the closest that I've ever been to those time periods is my father. He's born in the 40s, so he's always like, hey, the 50s were like this, 60s, all the way through. But when you get to sit down in a cinema... Now, initially, I did think it was going to be all about the Mansons, and it really was
not. It's not. We will come to that.
We'll come to that later.
Show.
To just sit back and go, okay, so I'm just... looking at things like, oh, that's what the cars look like. Okay, no one's wearing seatbelts.
Yes.
Oh, they're smoking in theaters. Oh,
yes.
There are rated NC-17, like, public film areas. There are, like, hitchhiking, like, taking place. The whole hippie, anti-hippie situation.
Right.
There's so many things that – and then – and this is a part of it that is also very cool when I saw it both times, especially the first time – all the references that you picked up, I know they're real, and I know that he put them there for a purpose, but I didn't catch any of them. So it's like, oh, I know that must be important. I'm sure that was a popular show.
But here's the thing. I would say this to he made every effort to get his time period accurate, and there's nothing in there that's sloppy. And there even – I do want to see it again. There's this great line where – but using computer generated effects, he's talking to someone, maybe his eight, I think he's talking to Al Pacino. He's talking to someone about how he got, Steve McQueen got the part in The Great Escape instead of him.
Yeah.
And he has, and DiCaprio's character has this great line where he says, yeah, I lost out along with the three Georges. And he says, George Peppard, who was in the original TVA team, and two other real actor names from that time. Yeah. And you sit and laugh and go, yeah, that's still happening now where, yeah, I lost the part to, you know, Matt Damon or whatever it may be. And all that stuff is correct. Like, he's not hammering anyone.
Yeah.
It's all accurate. Yeah. And Brad Pitt comes home and he's got Mannix playing on the TV, the number one TV show of its time. And that's correct and accurate. And there was, to your point, there was this notion of, he wanted, he didn't want to just sort of look at it through rose-tinted glasses. Mm-hmm. No, he was accurate too. But it is still a surprise. And I think because of that, it's warm. And here's the other interesting thing, to your point, when you talk about the era, and you've said yourself that, and this is good because we do have that generation difference. Mm. Things of that era that tend to dominate our conversations now, you know, Vietnam, presidents, this sort of thing. He put all that stuff into the background and he just let all the pop culture stuff stay in the foreground.
Absolutely.
And in a strange way, that was a conscious decision. Yeah. But that's also a very accurate reflection of how we live our lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know?
And so for someone like me, I would go, of course, Vietnam. You would sit there and go, Vietnam.
Yeah.
But this isn't a Vietnam movie. And this isn't a movie about 1969 per se.
Absolutely.
It's just about movie about being in
1969. And that added to the warmth, I felt like.
Yes.
Because it's he could have very easily flipped it and had the social issues kind of be at the forefront of the film, and then the pop culture things popping in and out, which once again, for someone my age, I think it would have taken away.
Would have been a different film, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because for me, I would have been like, okay, like this is really serious. Because at my age, when you hear Vietnam, you just think of like the worst war ever. And it would have taken away a pop culture reference coming in and out. I probably wouldn't have caught it because you're paying attention to the socially conscious issues. So I enjoyed the fact that it was like, okay, we know that these things are taking place and they allude to little pieces of it. And because I'd asked my dad, like, why did everybody hate hippies? And he broke it down for me. So the second time I saw it, I was like, I get it. But I like that it wasn't forced into my face. Yeah. I really enjoyed really getting to see, with no cell phones, with no smartphones, with, it seemed like the cars didn't even have seat belts, manufactured differently. What were people doing back then? How do you bounce back from being a big star without social media and a million followers?
That's a great point.
How do you bounce? Yeah, like, because there have been similar situations with people in the entertainment business in my family to see it on television. Like, I have to, am I going to go to Italy and do their Westerns? Makes more money, but because in this day and age, no one disappears.
That's 2 million
followers.
No one slums it now because of social media sort of making everything. Yeah. And I was reading in the paper today that someone has just passed 100 million subscribers and is now the YouTube. I'm like, I don't even know who that person is. But you're right. Yeah. There is no sort of like second division.
Yeah.
But in those days, without social media and the computer, there
you're
was.
Done. Yeah.
And one of the angsts in the movie for one of the leads for Leo DiCaprio's character Rick Dalton is his agent is telling him his agent is telling him to go to Italy
and
he's
not
sure he wants to go
to
Italy
want
to
go
and be in one of these spaghetti westerns because that's kind of already been done
but
that was the sort of choice that he had.
I enjoyed that.
Before we get to some of the controversies, does the film have any weaknesses for you, though? Because I'm now going to take you to task here. Because you sat there and made it 1A on Tarantino's list.
Yeah,
if this was the perfect movie, it would be 1 and not 1A.
That's true. That's true.
Let's now be fair while we gush over Quentin Tarantino. Does it have any of his weaknesses? What are its weaknesses for you, if there are any?
I'm sure that they could have taken out 20 minutes of the film. Now, I don't know what gets taken out. I think that it's a tough one for me, but if they were to say right now, we're going to release it on Blu-ray and it's going to be 2 hours and 20 minutes and they just edited out little scenes here and there.
Driving around. Brad Pitt can drive around for 90 seconds.
Exactly. I think they could have trimmed it because without getting to what we're going to be speaking about later, the end of the film, that is almost a film in itself. That last 40 minutes. And when you're aware of the intensity of that part of the film, I think they could have segued into that quicker and given that part of the film the extra time, if anything.
Okay.
So we're either cutting out minutes to shorten the film overall or redistributing some of those minutes. I would have loved if that the movie had been split like 55-45. We have the first part of the film, we're riding around, we're developing characters, and then when it transitions to what the end is,
what it's about,
give that an hour.
Yeah.
Because when that ended, at least when in the theater I was in, a lot of people were like, man, I could have watched 15 more minutes of
that. You took the words right out of my mouth. That would be my same criticism is that, and I think I said it to you because you and I talked a couple of days after, and I just said, oh, I've seen it now.
Yeah.
And I said, let's not talk about it because we want to have the discussion for real on the show.
Yeah.
I did say that there were a couple of moments when it felt, in classic Tarantino fashion, slightly self-indulgent.
Yeah.
And that's my criticism of him because I remember when I first saw Reservoir Dogs, no one knew who he was. He was the first independent dude going from nothing to putting a true independent movie up on screen. Reservoir Dogs is about an hour and 45 minutes. And ironically, none of his films since have been anything less than two and a half hours. And I'm thinking, but it's strange to your point. There are moments when I'm watching it and I'm thinking, yeah, I could have done with, you know, 2 minutes less here. Yeah. And, you know, what's his Damien from Billionaire, Billions, is Steve McQueen. Yeah. And he gets like one line and that's it. And I'm thinking, well, you know, a strange way you can get rid of that whole scene altogether. Yeah. It doesn't change anything. And yet, to your point, when it finishes, I want to sit there for another 45 minutes just hanging out with the lives of DiCaprio's character.
Absolutely.
And Pitt's character.
Absolutely.
So it's this weird contradiction of itself.
It's strange. And by the way, Billions was great this year. I just wanted to say, whatever you guys are doing, keep doing it.
He did a killer.
Yeah.
I forget his last name. And he's an English actor. Because he was in the original series Homeland or whatever that was on TV where Claire Danes was the CIA agent.
Billions is his thing. Yeah.
He does a killer Steve McQueen, but he's only on screen for like 120 seconds.
That's to both of our points. For me, in that moment, because you hear the name Steve McQueen consistently. If you're just a young person who likes films, I would have loved like 5 minutes of really getting into, hey, this is Steve McQueen, and this is kind of what he was about in that time period, and kind of having a point of reference with, okay, he was a big deal, or maybe he wasn't, whatever it was.
This is my point where the criticism isn't that it's too long, it's that it gets too self-indulgent. Yeah. And what I mean by that is, if I have a criticism of Tarantino over the years, is because he gets so hyped out about something, I think the films sometimes lose their balance.
Yeah.
And stuff that you think, actually, it makes more sense for the story to pay attention here, get short shrift. And in areas where it's like, yeah, you've kind of made your point, move on. I still think that is a fault of his sometimes, where I think he personally goes, oh, yeah, and then he gets...
I actually have an example, and I don't feel like it's a huge spoiler because it doesn't really give anything away about the film, per se, or the storyline. But when he goes to, like, the little commune, and then his tires get popped, like, I don't need to see the chick get on the horse, ride the horse all the way to the other side of the property, get the guy that they wanted to confront, exactly, Brad Pitt. Yeah. He gets on his horse, rides it all the way back just for what the result was.
Because it doesn't build any dramatic tension. That dramatic tension for that whole section of the movie is already building from the moment he steps onto the ranch.
Absolutely. Yes. So little things like that, you take that 2 minutes and you put it in that last 45. And I would have loved to know like 5 minutes more of like, hey, so what really happened?
What really happened? Because that is a real place. Yeah. And the dude that Bruce Dern plays that apparently was supposed to have been Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
The dude who he plays is a real person, which I did not know till after the fact, because that was a real place where it is said that members of the Manson cult hung out. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's get before we're not going to get to the ending yet, because that's when I will say spoilers. Mm-hmm. Let's get to some of the controversies.
Let's do it.
Let's start. Bruce Lee is depicted in the movie, a hilarious scene, which I should have punched up. Bruce Lee is depicted in the movie. Bruce Lee's family came about and, you know, did the classic Hollywood thing. Who knows if it's really a big deal to them, but some writer made it into a big deal. They felt that Bruce Lee was portrayed very unfairly.
Yeah, inaccurately, I guess. First off, before we go any further, I'm a huge Bruce Lee guy. Now, not in terms of all of what he did for cinema and how he used karate to try to and mix martial arts in ways that never been seen in cinema.
Had just, never been seen in cinema before. That is correct.
Just his, more of his teachings, his discipline, the quotes. I live by quite a few of them. One of my favorites is, I'm not worried about the guy who's working on all of his different moves. I'm worrying about the guy who works on one kick 10,000 times. It speaks to discipline. So the fact that he was in the film at all, a part of me is like,
he was another discipline that just happened to do acting. He's not an
absolutely.
Actor.
Absolutely.
And I don't mean that as a criticism.
And I feel like people need to be clear on that. Yeah. With that being said, the other thing about Bruce Lee that we have to be very honest about, there's not a ton of footage of him actually in mixed martial arts competitions. Like, Google him right now. There's actually not a ton of interviews, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know, outside of his quotes and what you hear from fighters of that era, what he was like. So when he's in this scene where he's fighting Brad Pitt, they're kind of going back and forth. And what happened?
Yeah, it's two dudes drawing each other.
Yeah, they're going back and forth. Brad Pitt,
stuntman,
just got his first stunt job in a while.
Yeah.
The film will kind of explain all that. You should go see it. Former Army guy and Brad Pitt, Bruce Lee. Now, when they step to each other, a part of me is like, Bruce Lee's going to rip this dude's head off at some level. And then Army training will prevail. And I'm curious to how that would work. I wasn't even bothered by how they kind of portray Bruce Lee as a little bit of a goofball.
A little bit arrogant, a little bit of a goofball.
But I actually thought that was extremely personable. I thought that was much cooler than, like, what I kind of view him as, which is very kind of, like, silent, super ripped, like, I'm not going to make a joke type of guy.
And they do show him later working with his Hollywood clients who went to him for training and whatever. And the other thing I would say about the controversy, and again, I'm not blaming Bruce Lee's family because I know how the media like to create a hoo-ha. And we have talked a lot about how this movie puts you in a time and a place.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as we're going to learn when we talk about the end, Tarantino isn't interested in providing historically accurate depictions of people, because let's face it, in Inglourious Basterds, he kills Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, yeah.
So to sort of try and create a controversy that, well, that's not what Bruce Lee was like. Yeah, I kind of get it, but in a strange way, you know, as we've said, Brad Pitt's character is a combination of two or three living people. DiCaprio's character could be any one Hollywood star. You have no idea.
Absolutely.
So again, this isn't some, I don't know. This isn't, I watched it the other week on TV, the Tom Cruise movie with all the dudes plotting to kill Adolf Hitler.
This isn't
that movie.
Yeah.
We're not trying to say this is history. Yeah. And so I felt like it was an unfair criticism.
Yeah.
And it is a tremendous scene in the film.
And also, in getting back to the combination of these two people, just so we're extremely clear, please, if as you listen to this, if you've seen the film already, because there are a lot of people like, Bruce Lee would have done this. If that was half Gene LaBelle, just so we're extremely clear, that is exactly how that fight would have gone.
Yes.
That is exactly, because if you Google the half of the character I'm talking about with Brad Pitt, Gene LaBelle, this guy was a monster. He was a freak athlete, and he was an extreme mixed martial artist who had definitive sayings and trainings that exist now.
And stuntmen in those days, they were hard to, because it's not like these days where, hey, I'm doing my own stunts.
Yeah.
No, in those days, you had the stunt guy do it because he might die. Yeah. These were tough hombres.
These were not guys who came out of liberal arts colleges who were like, I just want to be a stuntman. These had backgrounds in combat or in these intense environments like the Army, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, it's so funny when you speak about the difference between generations. When I speak to people who are older than me, the conflict was that Bruce Lee or not? Just how he was portrayed. When you speak to people, I would say like 35 and down, the issue is, would Bruce Lee have lost the fight or not?
Right.
So I'm just lightly touching on it objectively. My hero, one of my heroes, Bruce Lee, if he had run into Gene LaBelle in that situation, Google him right now. They have black and white pictures of him. This guy was an NFL-looking figure that was a monster in mixed martial arts. Bruce Lee ultimately is a statue that is 5'7". It's 145 pounds.
He's not a big guy, yeah.
Yeah, he would have been thrown into that car, and whatever would have happened after that would have been it. I just want to put that in there for sure.
So, yeah, I felt like they have some fun with the persona and character that was Bruce Lee? Yeah. Yes. Is it? But I didn't feel like it's some sort of like, slight I've been anything. Defamed and stuff.
And the merchandise is selling, by the way. Bruce Lee stuff has been selling out the roof since.
And Bruce Lee, to be fair, you know, you've talked yourself about how you see him.
Yeah.
There does come a certain moment when in Hollywood you sort of get inoculated from anything.
Yeah.
People can say whatever they like about Paul Newman. It's not going to change how you feel about Paul Newman.
Absolutely.
People can say whatever you like about Steve McQueen. It's not going to change how you feel about Steve McQueen. Yeah. People can say whatever they like about Bruce Lee. It's not going to change
how you feel about Bruce Lee. It's not going to change how I feel about him at all.
Yeah. The other controversy also, of course, is the depiction of Sharon Tate, played by Margot Robbie. I want to be very careful because this is two guys talking. So I'm going to say this now. If we say something that is offensive to you out there, we do not mean that in any way as a reflection of how we look at it. I don't see what all the fuss is about. Also because, and I'm going to say this, so Sharon Tate, obviously a real person, she was murdered by the followers of Charles Manson at Roman Polanski's home. We're going to get to the end of the movie shortly, but it is sort of the driving force that sort of looms over this film, the murders that occurred that night. Mm-hmm. But her actual depiction, she doesn't have a lot of dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I don't know Sharon Tate, but there was nothing in the movie that made me think ill of her. And in a strange way, the only criticism you could make of the film is that, well, Margot Robbie's playing Sharon Tate, but in a strange way, there are actually two other female characters that are far more important to the plot.
Absolutely.
The young actor on set with Leonardo DiCaprio, and then the girl, the hippie, who hangs around with Brad Pitt in a strange way. Mm-hmm. You know, so this notion that somehow Tarantino's sticking it to women again, which has followed him through his career, I didn't get that.
I
didn't get that from the character of Sharon. Now, again, I don't know much about Sharon Tate.
No, me neither.
But I felt really like, don't. Again, this is sort of like a slightly lazy, half-assed, let's just put the boot into Tarantino for other films where he has treated his female characters poorly.
Rougher. Yeah.
But I didn't feel like that occurred in this movie.
I think that the best...
In a way that I don't think it's a violent movie.
Absolutely. I think that when you start with your initial point, it's a warm kind of drama. I didn't see anything in this film, rather it be the issue with Bruce Lee, the controversy, or Sharon Tate, or how the women were treated in the film, or how they were depicted in that time period. Now, I was not of that time period, but I did not see anything that would cause a red flag. And the only person I had to lean on in terms of like Sharon Tate was my father, who was in the entertainment business at that time period. He saw all the trailers of how she was depicted, which honest to God is her, the entire film. He was like, yeah, Sharon Tate.
Interesting. Is it an underwritten part? Maybe. Yeah. Because it symbolizes.
He's frustrated about that.
But he's using it as symbolism. But it's not a part that was written that, to me, had any kind of...
Yeah.
It's not misogynistic.
Yeah. I didn't think so at all.
The little kid who plays the little child actor, those scenes are brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. And
he's written them in such a way that the Leo DiCaprio's character is the child.
Yeah, absolutely.
The relationship between Brad Pitt and the actress you spoke about who plays the hippie, which sort of, in a strange way, sort of starts to frame the climax of the film.
Yeah.
I don't know. If you're a hippie, you might feel it's insulting to you. But I can't, again, and I'm not a woman, and I don't mean to say this in any which way.
Yeah.
I didn't, again, Tarantino's done a lot of stuff over his years where you go, not cool, and that ain't right.
Yeah.
But this film wasn't one of them.
I didn't feel it at all. And with so we're very clear about the hippie and Brad Pitt situation. That could have been the most inappropriate scene or pairing ever.
Yes.
Strictly on the ages of the characters being depicted.
He didn't go that route.
He didn't. And I was expecting him to. I was getting a little like, oh boy, I wonder, is he really going to tap into what this could be? And which is just an older man with a much younger female. He didn't. Her purpose was really, I'm kind of going to show you where the commune is or the ranch is. And she played some roles later, and that was kind of it. I think the only thing that he touched on with her was like, hey, there are hitchhikers, and she was picked up once by Brad Pitt and once by Margot Robbie. And
that's right.
That blew my mind more than anything, just the hitchhiking in itself.
That's right.
And I was going to say really quickly about the Margot Robbie with Sharon Tate. I was thinking that people were going to be very insulted or pissed with the idea that Margot Robbie was not in the film enough. I was baffled by the betrayal of Sharon Tate being the issue. I mean, how many lines did she have?
She didn't
less
have
than
a lot.
25.
She doesn't have a lot.
Yeah.
And in a strange way, you know, she to me, she sort of moves through the movie because she is symbolizing something rather than her. She's symbolizing a big change that's about to come in society.
Yes.
Because this film does sort of feel like it's at that moment bridging two decades. I know you had that conversation with your dad.
Absolutely.
And she's also symbolizing sort of like a loss of innocence. So I didn't feel like, yes, I understand. Have you overcast? Maybe.
Because
if you have, but again, Arnold Schwarzenegger has 17 lines in The Terminator or something. So anybody, but she gets plenty of screen time.
Yeah. And once again, the merchandise is selling if you didn't know that.
So I did feel like some of the controversies are the, hey, we need a controversy. Here comes Tarantino. Let's get it out the back pocket.
Yeah,
it is not that film. It's not.
It's not. I saw it the second time with like 9 women. Not one had an issue. They can't speak for the country, and neither can I. But not one. Like when we got in our cars and then 8 later.
The Django Unchained is far more controversial in how it depicts race and how people treat each other.
Absolutely.
The Hateful Eight is far more controversial about how it treats women and some of its lesser characters.
And some issues in Kill Bill as well.
Yes, and issues in Kill Bill. Yeah. Those are all legit criticisms that could be thrown at Quentin Tarantino.
Maybe Pulp Fiction.
If you're put off by straight violence, you can level that at Pulp Fiction. Yeah. You can level that at Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
But to say those things about this film,
I don't see it.
In a strange way, you knew it was Tarantino, but it didn't feel like Tarantino's film until you get to the end. So now, as we talk about the end, spoilers. If you haven't seen the film, click off now.
Absolutely.
Because everything we say after this will be massive spoilers, and I don't want you all whining that Richard and I blew the doors off your dreams. And if that's the case, why haven't you seen this film yet anyway?
Absolutely.
That's my whole rule about spoilers.
Yeah.
If we're giving you spoilers now, then you don't want to see this movie that
Absolutely.
Much anyway. So let's start. The ending is very violent.
Oh, man. Yeah.
I mean, and it's harsh.
Yeah.
It's harsh.
Yeah.
And yet,
it was well done, man.
It didn't take me out of the film in the way that by rights it probably should have.
It because the transition was so smooth. It was a seamless transition from, like we said earlier, character development. Here's the storyline. But the whole time this film is going on, when you realize as a viewer, this is not about the Manson family. This entire
it's
film is not
about
the
Manson murders.
So.
And it's interesting how that's been the narrative.
Yeah.
And it's true. When you sit and watch the film,
you're like, where's
it sort of hangs over the film like this looming, like things are not going to end well.
Yeah.
And again, we've talked about how this is a war movie, and we've talked about how these guys, it's great, it's funny, we're loving hanging out with them. That's also tempered by the fact that you know something bad is coming.
And I felt like they handled it well in terms of, okay, since we've laid it all out, I felt like they were going with the transition like, all right, now we're just going to show you, we're going to introduce what happened next. And like, was it violent? Absolutely. Were flamethrowers used? Absolutely. Did Brad Pitt and his dog
Floyd
Mayweather an entire group of people? Yes. Was there somebody in a pool blind who was flamethrowered? Yes. But I don't know how to explain it even with that. I was just impressed by the pace of it, how intense it was, how alarming it should have been, and how like respectable it
is. And so here is the big spoiler if you haven't seen the movie. Everything will tell you this is Quentin Tarantino's take on the Manson murders,
Absolutely.
Where Sharon Tate and other people and some of her friends, I think 6 or 7 people, were murdered in
One
the home
left.
Of Roman
yeah.
Polanski.
Yeah.
But in the movie, and I didn't notice.
Me neither.
The killers don't go to Roman Polanski's house. They end up in Leo DiCaprio's house. And like at the end of Inglourious Basterds,
they are
Quentin Tarantino makes it clear, I'm not giving you a true story.
Absolutely.
Basically, I think this movie started where they all sat around and someone said, hey, what would have happened that night if the Manson killers had gone to the house next door? Yeah. And that is actually what ends up happening here.
And they,
So to your point, it is violent. And I'm not suggesting that this is an excuse for the violence.
Yeah.
But Margot Robbie's Sharon Tate doesn't get killed in this movie.
Yeah.
So right there, he is not depicting a true moment. This is the same thing he did with Inglourious Basterds, where the ending of that is people just getting whacked.
Yeah.
But at a certain moment, get away with it is the wrong word.
Yeah.
But because while I'm telling a story here, people, I'm not telling a documentary.
Yeah.
Did that throw you?
Yeah, absolutely.
It did throw me.
It threw me.
I kept waiting for the version of reality to occur, and it didn't.
That threw me. First off, there are two things that threw me. One, what you just said. I'm thinking, okay, Manson's going to pop up. He's going to have 30 minutes of explaining what they're going to do.
They're going to kill. Go do it, they're going to kill Pitt and DiCaprio, and then go kill up the and other
kill
dudes.
Everybody. Yeah. And that's a crucial point, because if you have an issue with the violence in the film, you know the entire time there's going to be violence. We're just all assuming it's going to be people getting knifed at night.
Yes.
What it turns into is they went to the wrong house. And that house that they went to happened to have had a young man named Brad Pitt with his dog, who we didn't kind of know the whole time was like army trained.
Yeah, army trained.
And he snaps his fingers and the dog just rips some
people's
heads.
And DiCaprio's character, who we knew has a famous scene in the movie with a flamethrower, but we didn't know he killed it at home.
Yeah. And so, and I thought it was so cool, because when it was all handled and it was all done and the dust settled, the coolest part about it to me was Leonardo DiCaprio's character ringing Sharon Tate. Well, the guy comes down.
He gets to meet his neighbors
who are these famous people who, if you're older than me, you probably are way more hip to who they actually are. But for me, it was like he went through all of this in his film career, and then he kind of prevented this, what we know as a massacre. And the reward is he gets to meet his neighbors who are famous and gets invited up.
And
his career is going to be real nice.
And it's very well done.
I would have loved, just give me 5 minutes of him just having a good time and telling that story, man.
It is a great story, and that when the film, and we said this earlier, you want to hang out with those guys more.
Absolutely.
And it is this interesting sleight of hand. And, you know, he did it in Inglourious Basterds. And I must say, when I watched that movie, I didn't like it.
Yeah. Oh.
I still don't like it.
Okay.
I enjoy moments of it. I enjoy Christopher Waltz's performance.
Yeah.
Especially that opening scene in the house with the girl. Yeah. I enjoy the army office sitting around, including Michael Fassbender and Mike Myers.
Yeah.
And I enjoy the moments. I enjoyed the performance of Pitt and some of those other guys. Is it Eli Roth, the actor, the shock horror director, one of the team in that. I enjoy those moments. And yet at the end of it, when all the Nazis get killed, I'm like, what? I didn't get it first time. Yeah. I'm like, what? You're doing this to me?
But it worked in this one somehow.
And I couldn't decide if it works in this one.
Yeah.
I couldn't decide. And this is the question I was going to have for you.
Yeah.
Does it work in this one because he's done it before? Does it, or does it not work in this one because you can't just keep using that as your gimmick?
Well, I think it just—it's
like having a movie about the Titanic where the Titanic doesn't sink.
That's true, which would be a great film.
But I don't know.
Tarantino should do that one too.
Leo DiCaprio would be in it.
Yeah, again, we can run that whole one back. I think it works for a different reason. I think it works because they the 2 hours previous set it up perfectly.
It does, doesn't it?
You really think you're about to ride off into the sunset, some people are going to get killed, and the film's over. And I just felt like how they handled everything before that last 30, 40 minutes made it an easy transition. And then there was a rhythm to the pace where even though people are getting killed, you connected with the characters already. So as these people are exiting with gruesome deaths, it just worked. I never even really thought about it until today. We kind of already did it with Inglourious Basterds, because I do.
So you're not offended by the gimmick?
No. No. But I did think Inglourious Basterds, that element turned a lot of people off of that film. And I thought that if he would have advertised that with this, like there's going to be a twist, I think it could have ruined the film.
You make an excellent point there. I might have been the same way.
Yeah.
Because I didn't like Inglourious Basterds. Yeah. Not that he wanted to take liberties with the truth,
yeah.
but the fact he sprung it on me at the end of a movie yeah. that has set me up a certain way yeah. emotionally. He gets away with it here
yeah.
because now, if we'd gone, this is Quentin Tarantino's version and he's going to change the ending,
yeah,
I might have rolled my yeah. eyes and gone, I ain't giving this movie the time of day because yeah. I'm still angry about yeah. how yeah. Glorious Bastard, what yeah. I was so unhappy with the
yeah.
way that ended.
Yeah.
And fair or foul, it has colored how I see the prior yeah. 2 hours and 45 minutes. But in a strange way, having experienced it this time and seeing him get away with it, I sit there and go, that was a really savvy move. And there's a part of me who almost feels like, I'm going to forgive you, Inglourious Basterds. I'm not going to revisit that film.
Yeah.
But I'm going to forgive it to you because yeah. this is you perfecting yeah. your gimmick that you wanted to pull off here. Yeah. Because he pulls it off here with such great aplomb yeah. and then he gets to deliver.
Yeah.
And I think this is what has angered me about... Not criticism of Tarantino's career, criticism of this movie.
Yeah.
Tarantino comes, when you're done, he's actually produced for you mm-hmm. a really warm, happy ending
yeah.
to a really warm movie.
Yeah.
And in a strange way, if he'd followed the truth at the end of yeah. the film,
I don't think it fits.
It would have been a real bummer to yeah. the rest of the film.
Yeah, I don't think it fits.
So what he said was, I'm going to tease the audience with a bummer might be coming. Mm-hmm. And in a strange way, I'm not going to give you that bummer.
Absolutely.
Because you guys have stayed with me for 2.5 hours and you've had a great time. Absolutely. I hope you've had a great time. And I'm going to give you a great time.
Absolutely.
And he delivered that, didn't he?
Absolutely. I felt that, first off.
You can't keep doing it.
No, yeah. I don't
but
know
he gets
how
away
you do
with
it
again.
This time. Yeah, that's the thing. I don't think you can do this again for if you're only doing 10 films.
I'll give you two where you do this.
Yeah, you can't do this one again.
No.
Star Trek better kind of follow what, because those people will lose it. But you're right. I just thought that with this,
you can't kill Captain Kirk. You can only kill.
Yeah,
Spock.
I would.
Spock,
if there's any thought of you killing Captain Kirk, man, I would back off of that immediately.
Because J.J. Abrams tried that, and then I'm backing out of that too. Yeah.
And you know what? I wish Tarantino would have gotten Star Wars instead of Star Trek. That's another show.
Another show.
But I just thought the setup and the fact that you're so certain that Sharon Tate's going to be killed, and I kind of started thinking, now that I really sit back and think about how I felt in the film, I remember thinking like, this is going to kind of suck when they got dropped off.
Point.
I remember
that's
thinking
a great
like,
point. Because you think
they're all going to be
because
killed.
You think yeah. they're all going to be killed, and yeah. Sharon Tate has, you know, Margot Robbie as Sharon Tate has sort of floated through this movie, yeah. just sort of being this. Like sort of almost saintly is the wrong word, but like, yeah,
yeah
she's good.
Cool.
She's nice.
Yeah.
She's innocent.
Yeah.
She represents all these things.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see her give a bad word. You don't,
yeah.
you know.
And I thought they
yes.
were going to kill Brad Pitt and Leo. So I'm thinking not only are they going to kill who we know is going to be killed, Sharon Tate, which is played that way. I'm thinking like they're going to kill my bros, man.
It's interesting. Yeah. In Inglourious Basterds, you think it's going to end badly.
Mm-hmm.
And when he changes your mind by having to end in what should be a victory, I don't know. I feel like I was cheated.
Mm-hmm.
On this movie,
mm-hmm.
when it happens, you sit there and you go, oh my God, thank God. Oh,
yeah.
thank God. Thank
yeah.
God. Thank God. Thank God. Thank
yeah.
God. You're relieved.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm not saying now this is awful now because it sounds like we and Tarantino are trivializing something that's really, really awful.
Mm-hmm.
But in a strange way, you have to acknowledge, everyone's acknowledged how awful it is
mm-hmm.
because you're right.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of hangs over the movie where you keep thinking, ooh, things are going to start going south.
And especially because in the...
And so he doesn't have to show it to you because
yeah,
you already feel
you already know,
it.
And, yeah, you
and
know
that's the
that
great
it's
thing,
happening.
And he knows that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very mature piece of storytelling.
Absolutely. And I think that also, especially for my generation, why the Manson thing was kind of looming over us a little bit differently is, in the last like year or two, the fascination with the documentaries of these people... Manson, Dahmer's had a film, then he's
yeah.
had his, My Friend Dahmer, Ted Bundy's been done like 3 times. In my head, with the people I was with the second time, because they hadn't seen it, so I hadn't spoiled it for them at all, they were all, you could see it in their face, they were like, okay, so Manson's going to lead this cult is going to go kill all of these people that we've just fallen in love with for 2 hours.
Yes, yes.
And it's going to be like just a bloody death. Like
yes.
it's going to just be a Tarantino
yes.
version of that. So I think with at least 9 chicks, they were all like really happy with, hey, you got to meet Sharon Tate, his career's probably going to get another shot. And they really dismantled him.
And, and in a strange way, when it leaves, because you know that he played it not just fast and he just suddenly ignored the truth.
Yeah.
Because he's ignored it for the story, doesn't in any way in a strange way, because of how you felt for the prior 2 hours, knowing that what's coming is coming, mm-hmm. or even though it doesn't come, you don't go out later going, oh, yeah, what was all that about? No, yeah. you get it. You're yeah. like, yeah, it must have been horrible. What happened yeah. that night? He almost underlines the horribleness of it yeah. by deciding, actually, I'm going to give you a different ending.
Yeah. And I thought the camera work in terms of when they're walking up the hill and their angles where it's behind and they're carrying the knives.
Oh,
and
you can then all of it.
Flip it around really and well see. Done. Very well
sort
done.
Sort of that,
well
that thriller technician Absolutely. That he often is was well done there. Yeah. We touched on this a bit earlier. And I'm one of those people, I don't necessarily believe he's only going to do 10 films.
Me neither.
But if he stopped now, knowing how we both feel about this movie, would we go, yep.
I would.
Is this an Oscar? If this movie's not nominated for an Oscar, I'm not just talking about directing and scripting and some of the, I'm just talking about if that's not movie of the year. And there's been some good stuff this year. I'm not going to say that wrong. And I know there's some good stuff to come.
Yeah.
If this movie's not nominated, people don't know what they're talking about.
I 1,000% agree. I agree with you.
And to be fair, if you said now, I don't care what else is coming out, we're giving it the Oscar now, I'm not sure how much of an argument I would make with you. I'd
be cool with it.
I could live with it.
Yeah. And like you said, there are two things I'd be very cool with. If he was like, I'm done right now. I'm not making anything else. I'm not going to do the Star Trek. I'd be like, this would be a great way to go out.
He says he writes them all out as novels first. I read that somewhere. Really I think, cool. or maybe was it in a, I either read it somewhere or it was in like an online, like a YouTube interview for Vanity Fair. There's loads of interesting stuff out there. And there's a lot of stuff of him. And then there's a lot of stuff with just him and Pitt and the actors. And then there's just Pitt and DiCaprio. And it's not often, you know, I do that about James Bond. It's not often I troll into that stuff, but I was fascinated about this one because I thought, and especially when I'd heard he writes it all as a novel and then he adapts his own novel for the screen. He says he's always worked that way, which is why he's only done this many movies. I think it's his best work. And other than the end, which in itself is one gimmick, it's also his less... I think it's his least gimmicky work.
I agree with that.
And there is a danger sometimes. This is one of the reasons I didn't like Pulp Fiction, because I felt Pulp Fiction was very gimmicky.
It was. I mean, truthfully speaking, it is.
Pulp Fiction isn't my least favorite. Yeah. Pulp Fiction is, I think that's a bad movie. That's how strong that feels.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think it's a bad movie. Now, to be swear, I love Reservoir Dogs. I think it's close to perfect.
Yeah.
I felt Pulp Fiction was gimmicky, and I'm like, I get that Inglourious Basterds and this have one gimmick, but I felt it was also the least Tarantino movie in terms of.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Characters weren't speaking Tarantino.
Yeah,
he just written characters, and do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and
there were moments when you forgot it was. Yeah. You always know it's a Tarantino movie, but it wasn't a Tarantino movie.
Yeah, I don't know how to explain that. Like,
there were people just putting the F word before everything, and it wasn't.
It wasn't as consistently raw in its nature in terms of the language, the violence, the over the top language and violence. Actually,
and it was also all his other films. They're filmy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like characters talk like it's his version of how the character is supposed to talk, because that's what you expect from the dude with the gun door. You're right. This was just a film, and it wasn't
watched.
Yeah, it wasn't showy. Like, hey, this is a movie. It's packed full of movie references.
Yeah,
you know, I still think that there's my favorite scene is when they've done a black and white where he is guest starring on. Leo DiCaprio's character is the guest star on the FBI story for that week.
Yeah,
so he's playing the guest villain, right?
Yeah.
And so him and Brad Pitt are sitting there watching it, and DiCaprio, there's a scene. So they're watching the TV show.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where DiCaprio, who's playing the villain, has to jump out of the back of the truck.
Yeah.
And he has to do it himself, not his stuntman.
Yeah.
And Brad Pitt sits there and goes, yeah, that was a good jump. And DiCaprio goes, oh, thank you, man.
Yeah,
like it's a very – so it's about cinema.
Yeah.
Without being like when you watch the Grindhouse movies, they clearly wanted to make movies that look like a certain movie.
Yeah.
This is just a film that just happens to be about.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. But you know, to your point earlier, one of the questions you presented: if he retired right now, would you be okay with it? Now my expectations are so high for Star Trek that he's supposed to be doing.
But is he? Or is that just talk? That's just talking.
He talks.
It's talk.
Yeah.
Is he going to waste his time doing some franchise picture as his last movie?
I can't see it.
As his last movie?
But no matter what he does, now my expectations are through the roof.
That's how good this one is.
And this back-to-back-to-back-to-back.
Those movies aren't very good anymore. I thought Django was great.
Yeah.
If he goes Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and then Django, yeah. I'm sitting there going, oh, we've gone back to this stuff again. Yeah. I'd be disappointed.
Yeah, but I don't know how much higher he can go from this.
Good point.
Like, I feel like what you just said is more than likely going to happen. The next film is going to be far more Tarantino-y consistently.
See, it's interesting.
Yeah.
I just had this thought. And again, his own story as a person.
Yeah.
He worked in a video store.
Yeah.
He wrote a script. He tried to hustle it about. While this is a personal movie, clearly this is... Because again, he would have been in real life. He probably would have been 8 or 9 years of age. That's why it's got that golden glow. Mm-hmm. This is almost like he's written a tribute to his parents and to his youth by setting the movie then. Because he wouldn't... He's not our age in this. He's a little kid. So he couldn't have lived through it in the way that the characters lived through it. I almost feel, so it is a personal movie that way. I'd like to see him do a really, really personal movie. Not necessarily about his own life, but something that's just,
something more of this.
Because again, this was an incredibly warm film.
Yeah. You're going to, when for all of our viewers, when you see it, you're definitely going to understand where we're coming from. I think that. This is, if there was ever a film where you cannot read reviews before you see it, because it's going to put you in a certain place, good or bad.
And I didn't, to be fair.
Yeah, I don't do, that's why I didn't do it with this one.
I only watched the trailers.
Yeah.
And I kind of decided, well, it's Tarantino, who I've always liked.
Yeah.
And I don't like those films, but I've always been like, I don't have this predisposition that a lot of people have. And it was Pitt and DiCaprio, and I'm like, at that moment I'm in.
Yeah.
And I don't care.
Yeah.
And I don't care if it says 65% of Rotten Tomatoes. I'm in. Because it's them. The only thing that brought me off is the length.
Yeah.
Talking of length, it's our get out thing. He has said that he could have done a 4-hour cut if he'd been allowed to. I'm presuming that he will do what they did with Hateful Eight and do a Netflix version.
Yeah. 4 hours.
I got to tell you something. Even though both our criticism was he could have trimmed the movie experience.
I'll watch it.
I can't wait until that 4 hours.
Yeah, comes. I'll watch it.
Because I can't imagine.
Yeah.
And there are all kinds of other actors who filmed scenes that he had to live out his old body, Tim Roth.
Yeah.
There was someone else who he had to cut all the way out.
Yeah.
I am sure the Steve McQueen stuff got cut down.
Yeah.
Hey.
I'll watch the 4 hours.
I'll watch the 4 hour version of this.
Yeah. I would have watched 4 hours out of the gate anyway, but seeing this and then knowing 4 hours come, I can do another.
I'll do it. Yeah.
What, 80 minutes, 120? Yeah. But I wanted to. As we're kind of moving out, I think we're near the end of the show.
Yes. Yeah, we're at the end.
I just wanted to say something that's going on in film right now that is disgusting, and that is what Sony did this weekend. I just want to take 1 minute and speak on it if I can.
Do it. This is your forum, buddy. Set up the audience, though, for the people who aren't paying attention.
Really, really quickly. Everybody knows, if you've been watching all of our shows, a lot of them have been about the comic book genre. Long story short, I've mentioned multiple times, the stupidest part of all of it, Sony owning stuff and the MCU owning stuff and trying to do separate films of heroes that we grew up with. Sony, who their Spider-Man, which is the highest grossing film that they have ever produced.
That's correct. It just passed Skyfall.
I mean, ridiculous. Yep. I never thought it would do that. Contract negotiations have broken down between Sony and the MCU, which means one thing. Well, two things. One, Spider-Man will no longer be in the MCU Marvel Universe, which is disgusting because they believe they can make billion-dollar films without the MCU, which is disgusting. And for all, spoiler alert, for everyone who saw Avengers, Iron Man pretty much died for nothing. You know, he pretty much died for nothing. And I will never forgive Sony for this. I love Venom. I love Tom Hardy. They will not get a dollar out of me. Tom Holland is the best Spider-Man we've had since. And I'm disgusted with them for this. And if you go online, everybody is. Everybody is. So I just wanted to put that out there. If there's a single Sony executive out there, I just want you to know I will not be buying PlayStation 5.
I'm going to repeat Richard's Iron Man died for nothing line because we're going to finish the show.
Yeah.
I'm going to let you repeat it in a minute to finish the show. But I'm going to try and ease your pain for a moment.
Yeah.
Tarantino's last movie, actually is just putting them all back together. There you go. Yeah. There you go. As Richard said, cool Iron that. Man yeah. died for nothing. Yeah. Go and see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Absolutely. We will be back next month with some summer musings, yep. with some of the other stuff that came out this summer that I know we, you know, now that we get to September and those things head to mm-hmm. pay-per-view and yeah. what have you, yeah. we're going to talk a little bit about the summer Absolutely. Movie season in September.
Yeah.
Movie Richard, thank you, my friend.
Appreciate it. A lot of fun.
This has been Movie Richard's Movie Month, a production of the Atlantic Voice Network. Follow us on Twitter at Atlantic_voice, via email at AtlanticVoice@gmail.com, and on the blog at AtlanticVoice.net. Movie Richard's Movie Month.